Telebanking, telecommuting, teletherapy. Now we have telemedicine. You may never see or talk to a live human being again. Healthcare through computer networks. I'm Jude Tillman, and this is the Communications Revolution. Oklahoma, it used to take 4 to 6 days to have your x-rays read. Now it takes 60 minutes thanks to sending x-rays by computer. Two-way interactive video, real-time 3D images, digital sound sent back and forth between your doctor and a faraway specialist. It's all part of the growth industry called telemedicine. But what will the cost be to an already overburdened system? We're joined by two people involved in this new field. With us in the Berkeley studios of KPFA from Pacific Bell's Healthcare Market Group, Marketing Director Janice Rylander. And from station KCFR in Denver, Jim Grigsby, Senior Research Associate at the Centers for Health Services and Health Policy Research. Our look at telemedicine begins with this report from producer Steve Tokar.
Mrs. Norell?
Dr. DeFacto?
Yes. Sorry to keep you waiting. I have to go again, but I'll be right back. While I'm gone, I'd like you to take a few minutes to verify your medical record. Very simple, Mrs. Norell. Egbert will take you right through it. Don't worry, I'll be back.
I rushed down here to be on time, and look at all the good it does me. And now I get to wait for Edward.
Egbert, Mrs. Norell, I'm right here.
Where?
On the computer screen in front of you.
You're in the computer?
No, I am the computer. Egbert 5000, the doctor's computerized patient record system.
What? I have no idea what you're talking about, young man, young machine, whatever you are.
I'm talking about computerized medical records, Mrs. Norell. Look, here it is, 2014, and it's been about 20 years since you've seen the doctor, right?
Huh?
Yes, August 2nd, 1994, a funny rash that cleared up on its own.
And I haven't missed much since then, from what I can tell.
On the contrary, you've missed a lot. It might help if I filled you in.
But Dr. DeFacto...
Won't be back for a while, believe me. All right, back in 1994, when you last saw a doctor, automobiles were still powered by gasoline. The ozone hole was confined to the South Pole, and most medical records were kept on paper. Mm-hmm. Hospital charts, lab results, all of that. But a growing number of health professionals were envisioning a national computerized patient record system.
Whatever for?
I thought you'd never ask. Let's go into the data archives for an excerpt from a 1994 interview with Dr. Martin Findlater on the Board of Trustees of the National Rural Health Association. Ah, here it is.
There's a great deal of waste in, shall we say, the bureaucracy of medicine. And so this will help reduce the bureaucracy simply by being able to reproduce the same information on multiple occasions.
Not only that, say your doctor orders a laboratory test for you and writes a prescription.
I can enter that information on a computer. And with existing technology, that information can be transmitted to the pharmacy, to the lab, and you can save some steps that way, and will also reduce the number of mistakes that are made.
Ha!
Well, they were optimists back then, and sometimes they were right. Back to the data archives, 1994 again. Suzanne Henry, a nursing professor at the University of California.
What it might mean to you as an individual patient coming in for a visit, that rather than being asked once again to list all your current medications, your drug allergies, what diseases you may or may not have, you may be asked instead to just verify.
Which is what I'd like you to do. Just use the electronic pad and stylus there.
It says here I'm allergic to aspirin. That's not right. Oh, it must be because I was born in Aspen, Colorado.
Why not change it?
I'm trying, and nothing happened.
Well, I'll change it for you later. Now, the next technological breakthrough was to link all those computerized records into one big national database.
Uh-huh.
And this allowed you to start analyzing the information compiled,
uh-huh,
so that today you can do a national study on, say, the effectiveness of two different drugs on a particular type of patient.
That rash I had back in 94?
Exactly. Your doctor could have done a data search and found out that the cream he prescribed was useless in cases like yours.
My marigolds loved it, though.
Oh, really? I'll add that to the database. Ah, and then there are the online support groups, which are run by patients themselves.
What's that? Group therapy on the computer?
Not exactly. They're clearinghouses for information on the latest treatments and drugs and study results.
Oh.
Let's see. A 1994 interview with Wendy Hochstetter, a system operator for an online support group for attention deficit disorder, or ADD.
People definitely come away knowing far more than they ever imagined in far less time. Or we'll get people that say, I've been ADD all my life, and I've learned more in the past day reading this forum than I knew in all that time.
Well, really, I have missed a lot in 20 years.
And I haven't even told you about telemedicine yet.
Tele-what?
Telemedicine. Say you don't live in San Francisco, but hundreds or even thousands of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
You and your local doctor can still consult with Dr. DeFacto over a two-way interactive video system.
Mm.
Dr. DeFacto would examine you on camera without leaving his desk. You could see him, too.
You mean I'd actually get to see the doctor?
Patients, Mrs. Norell.
Oh, I'd see patients.
Never mind. Back to the Clinton era. 1994. Sherry Hostetler, executive editor of Telemedicine magazine.
One of the big tenets of Clinton's health care reform is increased access to health care. And, of course, increased access is one of the big reasons why people implement telemedicine projects, because you have a lot of folks living in rural or otherwise remote areas who don't have a lot of access to sometimes even any health care at all. And certainly not any kind of specialty health care.
The idealistic 90s.
Egbert, if you weren't a machine, I'd swear you were being wistful.
Well, Vivian, let's be frank. Computers can do great things, but we can also be used for other purposes. 1994 Data Archive. Dr. Rick Peters, head of corporate development for Oceana, a medical software firm.
Computer systems are going to make people more efficient. There's no question about it. They're going to eliminate a lot of steps in the process.
And as it turned out, they eliminated a lot of nurses. Computerized records allow fewer nurses to take care of more patients who are sicker, which means more machines and fewer people.
And it's a harsh reality that I think is a shame, because administrators are looking at that, and they're looking at automation making nurses more efficient rather than looking at automation eliminating middle managers, administrative overhead, and all of the red tape and bureaucracy that doctors and nurses have to deal with to take care of patients.
And then there's the question of secondary uses.
Uses of what?
Medical data. Excuse me, I'm losing.
Hi, Mrs. Norell. I'm Jody from Operations Unlimited, an overseas corporation. As a patient of Dr. DeFacto, you qualify for our frequent surgery plan. If you have 10 operations, for whatever reason, we'll give you the 11th free. Just call 1.
Hi, I'm back. Case in point, Viv. That's a secondary use.
They can break in just like that?
Security is never perfect, which is another weakness in the system, of course. But there you are.
There you are, Mrs. Norell. Sorry to keep you waiting so long. An unexpected telemedicine consultation.
Oh, you have rural patients?
Rural? I should say not. A clinic about 2 miles away. Not a neighborhood you'd actually want to be in, though, if you know what I mean.
Uh-huh.
Now, let's see your chart. Allergic to aspen trees. That's interesting.
Oh.
Now, Mrs. Norell, the procedure you've been recommended for is a total hip replacement. I'm not sure how much you understand about what's involved.
Wait a minute. You said hip replacement?
Yes, the entire left hip. Now, a woman of your age...
But my hips are fine. It's my big toe. I sprained it a few weeks ago.
Then why have you been referred to me, Mrs. Norell?
Darn if I know. I thought those nice young kids at the clinic knew what they were doing.
Egbert!
I found the mistake, Doctor. A technician transposed two numbers when Mrs. Norell was first treated, and the error just multiplied, as usual.
You know, Egbert, just once I'd like to get through a day without a screw-up like that.
Hi, Dr. DeFacto.
Egbert.
I'm Jody from Operations
Egbert.
Unlimited.
Jody, Egbert, Mrs.
Egbert.
Norell, and Dr. DeFacto are fictional
Egbert.
Creations. All interviews in Egbert's
Egbert.
Databanks took place in 1994 with real people.
Egbert.
This is Steve Tokar for the Communications Revolution.
Mistakes Made Worse by the Power of Computers. Janice Rylander, Marketing Director for Pacific Bell's Healthcare Market Group. The feature we just heard makes the future sound rather frightening, don't you think? Will you get fewer nurses, mixed up patient records, less contact with doctors? Is this an unfair caricature in your opinion?
Well, I think change is always fearful, or it causes fear in people. And I think that's what we're looking at here is sort of a revolution, call it the information revolution. And just as people were fearful of the car instead of the horse and buggy, I think you can concentrate on that. But I think there's a lot of benefits here. I think that we're still not talking about eliminating the human reaction in all of this. So I'd like to just characterize it as normal fear of anything that is different.
Well, one thing we want to do is try to sort out what fears are based in possible realities and what aren't. I mean, just this last notion that mistakes could be multiplied by computer. Some claim that a reduction of mistakes when using electronic databases will happen, and some claim more mistakes will happen. What's your opinion?
Well, my personal opinion is wherever you have a human being, you also have the possibility of mistakes, and that includes as humans interact with technology. But I think you have a lot more consistency that's passed on through technology, and I think that the benefits are there. But please believe that I don't believe that the human factor should ever go out of it, especially when you're talking about something like medical care. That's important for all of us, and even people who are involved in the technological revolution are still human beings and understand the importance of that.
All right, well, let's go over some of the benefits, as you note, of this new technological revolution. What are some examples, Janice Rylander, of the sort of telemedicine technologies that you're familiar with that are being implemented now? Let's identify what's going to become a household word in the future, like the word X-ray has become.
Well, maybe we need to step back and explain why Pacific Bell is involved in this first. There's really two ways. First of all, I belong to a healthcare market group that is really working with the healthcare community and identifying how telecommunications and technology can assist them both in the efficiency of their operations from an administrative viewpoint and a clinical viewpoint. And the other one is just bringing, from a Pacific Bell perspective, the benefits of the information age to the home.
Give us an example.
Well, Pacific Bell has invested $16 billion in putting the infrastructure into California. By the end of 1996, we should have 1.5 million homes connected to what is being called the Super Information Highway, which is really an advanced system for putting voice, data, and video into the home. Those two really converge together in healthcare through a program called CalRIN, and that's a research and education network trust fund that Pacific Bell set up. The information superhighway is going to be only as useful to people as applications are developed.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we did was develop some applications through a trust fund, or we didn't develop the applications. We had companies, healthcare organizations come together and develop healthcare applications.
These are pilot projects, right?
Pilot projects that use the technology that will be on the information superhighway.
These sound like it sounds like a big investment for something that's going to happen in the future. And let's come back to what that investment will look like in a minute. But in terms of what's already being implemented, I understand there are some 20 to 25 projects or sites for telemedicine going on around the country, and I'd like to bring Jim Grigsby into the discussion. Jim Grigsby, you were the principal investigator on a grant from the Healthcare Financing Administration, or HCFA, the agency that actually administers Medicare, to study the effectiveness of telemedicine. So you took a look at these sites that are currently operating around the country as opposed to things that are projected to come down the pipe. Give us your sense of what the successes were and what some of the downside was.
Well, there's quite a bit of variability among these telemedicine programs. In fact, right now there are probably just under 20 that are relatively active. We visited 8 of them, and I've spoken with people who run or work in a number of others. They are found in a variety of different places. For example, Tripler Army Medical Center in Oahu provides medical care to essentially to the whole Pacific. At the current time, they've only got one program operating, and that's between Tripler and an island about 2,200 miles away called Kwajalein, which is inhabited primarily by U.S. defense contractors and their dependents. In an area like that where there aren't very many flights between Oahu and Kwajalein, where it's very expensive to evacuate people by air for medical reasons, it appears that this approach to telemedicine is not only very innovative, but has the potential to save quite a bit of money and quite a bit of time.
Tell us exactly what they do on Oahu.
Well, they've got a variety of different programs that are available. I'd say the bulk of the work that they've done so far has been involving dermatology. And there are a number of skin conditions that are fairly common in the South Pacific, and therefore the need for dermatology is relatively high. So using interactive television, it's possible to see a patient, videotape that patient, or rather take a live recording of that patient on Kwajalein. That can be seen in real time by
a dermatologist.
Kwajalein is the island
on which
these defense contractors live. You can transmit that to Oahu, where a dermatologist can examine the patient with a high-resolution monitor and in many cases make a diagnosis that might mean that the patient doesn't need to be evacuated or doesn't need to have specialists come out and see him.
Which I imagine traveling from island to island could be quite expensive. Now, the other big victory or success story, I should say, for telemedicine is supposed to be in rural areas, which similarly to islands, has patients at quite a distance from their healthcare providers. Can you give us an example of how it's worked in a rural area, Jim?
It's worked variably. In some areas, it's worked quite well in that people who live in remote areas no longer have to get into their car and drive for 4 to 6 or 8 hours in order to see a specialist. Instead, they can often be seen in a community health clinic or a community hospital. The image is transmitted to a medical center elsewhere, and their conditions can often be taken care of. In some cases, patients with chronic illnesses, for example, have been monitored over time, followed regularly by a specialist to make sure that their medical care is proceeding properly.
We still have to have a description here of exactly what images or what exactly the technology is that one doctor is seeing on one end and one patient is providing on the other end. What exactly is the doctor looking at when they're seeing their patient 60 miles away?
Well, that depends on the exact specifications of the system. In some cases, what's used is a still image, so that essentially, let's say, for example, that a patient has a skin lesion of some sort. It's possible to take a still digitized photograph of that lesion and transmit that. And in fact, there are telephone systems, picture phone systems that will allow transmission of these still images. In other cases, it's a live interactive image so that the physician can see the entire patient, see a provider with a patient, do an examination if necessary. The patient can be looked at from different animal angles, can use different cameras so that you can get a macro lens and get a good close-up, or if necessary, for example, a neurologist might want to watch a patient walking across the room.
It really raises a question in my mind whether I want a doctor to diagnose a lesion on my skin by looking at a picture of it and not being able to touch it, probe it, I don't know, smell it, all of those kinds of things.
Well, it raises a question in some dermatologists' minds as well. While a number of people are very enthusiastic in their support of telemedicine, it's clear that there's still a fair amount of skepticism. And part of the reason for that is that there has not been sufficient research to demonstrate the effectiveness of telemedicine. Part of our study was to try to review the literature, the research literature, to find out exactly what we could say about its effectiveness. And apart from the use of telemedicine to transmit radiology images, so x-rays and CT scans and things of that sort, outside of that, there really isn't a lot of good evidence that telemedicine is effective.
Janice Rylander, would you agree that there's not much evidence to support telemedicine success?
Well, I think we're just now learning about what's going on, so I would agree that probably all the data isn't in. I think one area where telemedicine can be effective is in the second opinion, also, where you are in a situation where you are still with the doctor, and that second opinion is valuable and can be done through telemedicine as well, because, again, eliminating that human interaction, as we all know, is very important to us with our doctors, is a very scary thing. So the second opinion, I think, plays a big role and would certainly reduce the cost and aggravation for the individual and hopefully reduce overall health care costs.
In point of fact, the telemedicine projects that are currently operating haven't provided that much patient care. Is that true, Jim Grigsby?
Well, that's right. There's an oncologist at the University of Kansas named Ace Allen who did an informal study last year and found that in all the telemedicine programs in North America, if you don't count sort of very brief consults with a specialist about people who are on dialysis for kidney disease, fewer than 1,000 consultations were done in all of North America. And a lot of programs have had a great deal of difficulty getting going. One very large, well-funded program, for example, has spent $1.6 million over the last year and a half or 2 years and seen, I believe, a total of 16 patients.
Not cost-effective, I would suggest.
No, at $100,000 a patient, it's not very cost-effective at all. Other programs, though, have been able to increase patient volume and use the system reasonably well. But even in those programs, you find that they still may be only seeing 10, 11 patients a month.
Well, I think it is helpful to hear this and put some perspective. People are afraid, for instance, that their patient files are going to be on huge data banks, but currently fewer than 1% of this nation's hospitals even keep their records electronically. So a lot of these fears are projections of what might come down the road in the future. In fact, a lot of healthcare providers, physicians particularly, are reticent to involve themselves in telemedicine projects. Isn't that true, Jim Grigsby?
Well, that's true, and there are, I think, a number of different reasons for that. For one thing, because the research literature doesn't have a lot to say about the effectiveness of telemedicine, many people are concerned about whether or not the technology works. Generally, the people who are involved in telemedicine programs are believers, or I assume they wouldn't be very involved, but it looks as though telemedicine is reasonably effective, but for certain applications, it's not always clear. So they're concerned about liability. They're concerned about providing quality medical care, and they're not certain that they can do it, at least a certain percentage of providers. Others are really concerned about how it's going to affect other aspects of their practice. Right now, telemedicine is generally not reimbursed so that people can't get paid for it. It's also not clear to a lot of rural providers whether or not these programs are really intended to steal their patients away from them. So there's a fear that it'll undermine their practice or undermine the network of referrals that they have developed over the years.
You're listening to The Communications Revolution. You can contact us via email at kpfa@well.com, kpfa@well.com, or if you'd like to join today's discussion and talk about today's topic online, join us on the Internet on our IRC channel, which has the name TRP5. Janice Rylander, even the Healthcare Financing Administration noted recently that they're concerned that companies such as Pacific Bell and others are going to have a very entrepreneurial rather than patient care priority in implementing telemedicine projects. Entrepreneurial in the sense that they're going to go in and swoop and scoop patients away from rural physicians and center their care in large urban medical centers and thereby break the personal connection between doctor and patient. What's your response to that fear?
Well, first of all, recognize that Pacific Bell won't be delivering health care to people. It would be our working with doctors, hospitals, clinics to be able to help them deliver the type of health care that's appropriate over telecommunications. I think, again, it just goes back to there is a fear and a fear of change. And right now, doctors are probably the ones that are being squeezed the most, not only in terms of acceptance of telecommunications, but also in what's happening in moving our healthcare system in terms of reform, putting it from a fee-for-service into a managed care environment. So there are lots of fears there that are justifiable in terms of their own personal careers and what's happening to them. But telecommunications really can assist in both the administrative portion of their business and really provide some cost-effective ways to address administrative bureaucracy of healthcare. I think the clinical part of it, as Jim says, is a little bit more nebulous.
It's problematic. But there's certainly, how about the question of patient empowerment? There is certainly some indication that having huge online databases of healthcare information will help empower patients to learn more about their own health and their own diseases, if you will. Do either of you know of examples of this happening? Janice Rylander?
Yes, we certainly do. I think just through technology that exists today with interactive voicemail, many of the HMOs and the various healthcare providers are using within interactive voice response kinds of systems, the ability to have people gain information, to be able to answer their questions about routine health care that can assist when a young child is running a fever and the mother doesn't know what to do to bring that fever down, but yet all indications are it's not at a critical stage, but just something that empowers them to be able to access that information from the home. And that's as simple as your touch tone pad in some cases right now on your telephone. So we do see ways that people can gain more information, and I think those ways will increase in sophistication as home health applications develop. We're in a situation right now where we're moving from a sickness model to a wellness model, and in doing that, we've seen care move from the hospital as the central focal point to outpatient clinics and ultimately moving closer and closer to the home. And telecommunications can play a role, and I think it plays a big role in the education and the empowerment of bringing information readily available, easily accessible into the home.
All via your telephone, of
Absolutely.
Course.
Absolutely.
We're discussing telemedicine. Will it promote patient empowerment, or will it drive up the cost of health care, or do both? You've been hearing just now from Janice Rylander. She's marketing director with Pacific Bell's Healthcare Market Group. You're also hearing from Jim Grigsby. He's the senior research associate at the Centers for Health Services and Health Policy Research. I'm Jude Tillman, and this is the Communications Revolution. We'd like to hear from you right now. Give us your thoughts on high-tech medicine by calling 1-800-848-2298. That's 1-800-848-2298. We'll be right back.
The Communications Revolution is produced at KPFA, Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, with funds from the Telecommunications Education Trust, established by the California Public Utilities Commission. It's distributed by Pacifica National Programming. Barry Scott is executive producer. The associate producer is Carol Klinger. The managing editor is John Rieger. The associate editor is Claire Schoen. For a cassette tape or a written transcript of this program, call the Pacifica Radio Archive at 1-800-735-0230 and ask for the Communications Revolution, Program 594. This is the Communications Revolution.
We're talking about the ups and downs of telemedicine, or whether a day will come when computers care for you more than your doctor. Call us with your questions and comments at 1-800-848-2298. And we do have callers waiting on the line. Let's hear now from Rob in Petaluma. Hello, Rob. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Rob.
Hi. Yes. Well, I was wondering what the role of alternative medicine and, you know, natural medicine would be in this, in the process of all this. Is it just, you know, is this kind of being left out of the discussion, or, you know, what part is it going to play at all? Because it seems that the alternative medicine is very helpful for a lot of people, and it often is left out, and, you know, like the healthcare reform, it's not even a topic in, you know, Clinton's plan a lot. So I was just wondering what people had to say about that, or what people on the panel there and what you know how to say.
Thank you for your call, Rob.
Thank you.
It does seem to me, in what I've read about telemedicine, the legislation that's been introduced has to do with, will Medicare reimburse it? There are concerns about liability issues, as you brought up, Jim Grigsby. Everyone's concerned about mainstream medicine and how telemedicine is going to be a part of the new Health Care Reform Act. What about alternative medicine? Do either of you know what role that will be allotted?
Well,
Jim Grigsby.
It looks as though, if you just examine telemedicine at the present time, it excludes alternative medicine entirely. In part, that's because the impetus for a lot of these programs has come from academic medical centers where traditional mainstream allopathic medicine is practiced. Also, concerns about liability, concerns about reimbursement, and so on have made the field kind of tentative initially. One of the things about telemedicine, though, that people should keep in mind is that really what we're talking about is a medium for delivery of services. It's not like a CAT scan or an MRI, which is used for a specific kind of diagnosis. Instead, it's sort of a way of extending a physician's or a provider's office so that in itself, telemedicine doesn't exclude alternative practitioners. Instead, it provides a medium through which they could potentially provide services at a distance.
Our number here is 1-800-848-2298, 1-800-848-2298, if you want to join our discussion of telemedicine. It seems that from what I've read about telemedicine that they're really not paying much attention to alternative forms of therapy. However, in the world of cyberspace, if you will, for those people who are savvy about computers and bulletin boards and networks, there seem to be a lot of holistic therapy bulletin boards, discussion groups, groups that talk about acupuncture, and there's one particularly in the San Francisco Bay Area in which people are sharing information about attention deficit disorder, ADD, and there are different SysOp system operators who sponsor these discussion groups, these chat lines online, and talk about all kinds of issues. There's almost a Lorenzo's Oil type story every day of people who have some rare disease and are able to go online and research that disease. So I know that that exists, but there's also a real problem with it in terms of, well, two things that let me bounce off of both of you. One is the difficulty of use. You've got to definitely be computer savvy to do internet searches. And then second, the question of whether there might be a circulation of misinformation amongst these people. Do either of you have an opinion about that? Janice Rylander.
This is an example where technology links people to share information, and just as some of the examples you gave, I think there's always a chance for misinformation when you have people sharing in an unedited type of an environment. People still have to make their own decisions about where they get the information. In terms of the internet and the accessibility of it, there are also things that are available in terms of linking people right now just through telephones and support groups that you mentioned. So I do want to stress that there are different levels of linking people, and that's important to understand so that it doesn't turn out to be the haves and the have-nots, which mm-hmm. is certainly a concern.
The number here is 1-800-848-2298. We have Lorna from Long Beach. Hello, Lorna.
Hello. I heard the gentleman talk about the alternative treatment and the problems therewith. The other thing I'd like to know about is such thing as chiropractic, naturopathic, and so forth. Is the government going to put a clamp on it, such as they do now, with anything that is alternative and not the traditional, such as in cancer treatment, AIDS treatment, and so forth? There are many of these things that are known to the general public, but you can't get it on any sort of public media.
Thank you for your call, Lorna. Well, the government could put a clamp. It could be rephrased to question whether the government will include ever alternative therapies being covered by Medicare or being paid for. Certainly, they're not being paid by insurance companies or by the government. It is a form of putting a clamp on it. Do we have an opinion from either of our guests? Jim Grigsby?
Well, my guess is that things will probably continue as they are, that alternative therapies may be available by telemedicine, or at least diagnostic procedures that might be used for alternative therapies. But I think the question of whether or not they would be reimbursed by Medicare really goes beyond whether telemedicine would be reimbursed. Kind of a separate issue. Mm-hmm. Has more to do with the acceptance of homeopathy, naturopathic approaches, and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Which we're still a long ways from that sort of consciousness in America, I think. In terms of reimbursement, Jim, so far there's only one state in which the local Medicare administration is actually reimbursing for telemedicine. Is that true?
With kind of an exception, yes, that's true. In fact, teleradiology is probably being reimbursed right now, but nobody knows how much or to what extent, primarily because there's no separate way of coding that, but it's not officially being reimbursed. Otherwise, only Georgia has approved Medicare reimbursement for telemedicine.
Mm-hmm. The state of Georgia just, by the way, awarded a $4.5 million contract to a New York-based company to build a statewide telemedicine network. I wonder if that has anything to do with their optimism about its use in that state because they're reimbursing doctors. Perhaps doctors will be more willing to jump on the telemedicine bandwagon. Our number here is 1-800-848-2298, 1-800-848-2298. Concerning teleradiology, I mean, there have been radiographs sent through phone lines in the traditional way for almost 10 years, but now they're actually compressing and digitizing the images so that the whole process is speeded up. Isn't it true that the detection of certain kinds of fractures that don't have obvious fragments sticking out somewhere, they're harder to detect using digital images than the conventional radiographs? Jim Grigsby, do you know?
Well, that's true. The most recent research shows that certain what they call non-displaced fractures, so they're subtle fractures, the detection of them is quite a bit lower than with conventional X-ray film. There are also certain things that physicians look for on chest X-rays that don't show up as well on digitized images as they do on conventional film. It's not exactly clear whether this reflects in part lack of experience with the radiologists in reading digitized images, but the fact is there's a definite difference in quality.
Mm-hmm. So we might be trading off quality of health care for speed and access, particularly for rural inhabitants. Is that true?
Well, it's a possibility. I think, though, the prevailing feeling is that when practitioners know that a particular application of telemedicine is not as accurate or not as effective as conventional medical care, that they will avoid it.
Mm-hmm. Let's bring another listener into the discussion. Roger from Richmond, you're on the air. Hello, Roger.
Yeah, hi. I actually have a fairly specific question. I have a young friend who I live with who's been diagnosed with schizophrenic, and he's in trouble with the law for petty theft. And we've been trying to get medical help for him, but also now trying to get legal help through the Internet. And I've been having some success through the Internet with, like, a listserv that's devoted to schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. But I was just wondering if you had any Internet possible resource to go to about the legal end of it.
On the legal end, I'm not personally familiar. Do either of my guests have any idea on the Internet where a good source is? It sounds, Roger, like you're pretty Internet savvy already.
Yeah, I am. And this is coincidental because right at the moment I've been trying to work on this, and here you are on the air talking about it, so I thought I'd dial in.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us. Jim, do you have any ideas?
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Mm-hmm. You might just check, Roger, with what discussions there are. They usually have a listing of all the discussions on the Internet, and you can just take a search. I'm sure you know how to do that better than we do.
But all I could recommend would be the news groups or using one of the gophers.
Yeah. The question of patient empowerment, this is a good one. That it's good that Roger has the knowledge of how to search through the Internet for answers to his questions. But you really have to be pretty savvy, don't you, to be able to work your way through this stuff. And you're talking about telephone touchpad interaction, Janice. Is that something that the rest of us who aren't so computer savvy could be participants in?
Well, I think, first of all, information is out there and is as easily accessible as your telephone. You have to certainly be part of your healthcare system that offers that kind of information. And most people do know how to use the telephone. The medical community has been putting out educational information in a variety of forms. I don't know, way back in the 70s, they started by having people call numbers and cassette tapes were put in and messages were played. So this really is just the next step in the evolution. And I know there are many of the health maintenance organizations that are using this to educate. And so I would encourage people to ask their own healthcare providers how to access educational kinds of information. And, of course, the Internet is still there as well.
Mm-hmm. And for those of you who are on the Internet and would like to join our IRC channel, just go to the name TRP5 on the Internet, and you can join our Internet chat about today's topic of telemedicine. Let's bring in another caller, Mark from Lawrence, Kansas. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Mark. How are you today?
Good. My question involves the idea, getting back to the quality issue. We've been using the Telenet service in the area, and I have been involved in different ways, but I do see a quality difference in the fact that certain groups are able to purchase certain qualities of equipment. We're using everything from a wireless stethoscope to Doppler radar on chest x-rays, and I am seeing a big difference between one group's responses to the way they are, what equipment they're using, and the results they're getting are a higher quality than others. Are we going to start seeing some standards as well?
Excellent question, Mark. Thank you for your call. Jim Grigsby, do you anticipate some standards being set by HECFA, for instance, regarding these technologies?
Well, I think HECFA will be involved to a certain extent in setting standards for the use of telemedicine. A lot of the professional organizations are quite involved. The American College of Radiology, for example, is currently trying to establish standards for the use of teleradiology. And I think what we see right now is that the field is very immature. The various technologies are somewhat incompatible with one another, although some uniformity is developing. There isn't really adequate research at this point to say exactly what specifications a system should have, but I think that as more programs come online, more research is done over the next few years, and as the professional organizations become increasingly involved, we'll see kind of a natural evolution of standards.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 1-800-848-2298, 1-800-848-2298, if you want to join our discussion. The question of the standards being set so that these technologies are compatible with each other is one aspect, but the caller also raised the question of cost. Now, I would suspect that that's going to be a major factor in terms of who gets to have access to all these glitzy gadgets. I know, for example, Sprint, U.S. Sprint, is planning to charge $75,000 a month for an ATM system to link hospitals and rural clinics. And ATM means asynchronous transfer mode. That's the technology designed to handle a combination of two-way video, graphics, text, voice, etc. So just to put one of these systems in is going to be expensive, and then the cost per month. Now, is Pac Bell going to be charging that high a monthly cost, Janice Rylander? Do you know?
Well, I don't know, because every cost depends on every system. But I think what you're talking about here is healthcare providers making decisions that are based on two factors, and one is their bottom line and the cost effectiveness to their bottom line in the business, and the quality that it still maintains for their patients. So there are structured costs that would be associated with technology, but in most cases, I think what you're talking about is the efficiency, being able to deliver those services to a wider group of people, to be able to have more efficient use of personnel. And I think cost is a factor, but cost will be considered. And the push in the healthcare industry is to manage their costs, to keep them as low as they can. Mm-hmm. And so I think that technology has to be proven cost-effective, or the healthcare providers will not utilize them, because they will not be able to do that in a managed care environment, which has a fixed cost.
This cost question, Jim Grigsby, let's let you throw your hat into the ring as well. There are great debates about whether telemedicine technologies are going to, in the short run, cost us more, the healthcare system as a whole, and in the long run, save us, or vice versa. We're going to see a reduction of staff, for example, aren't we? What is your opinion?
Well, it's a complex answer. A lot of the people who are strong proponents of telemedicine argue that, in fact, telemedicine has already demonstrated itself as a very cost-effective means of delivering care to people in remote or rural areas or otherwise underserved populations. But I think the example that I gave earlier, for example, the program that's been functioning for a year and a half, 2 years, and seen 16 patients at $100,000 apiece, demonstrates that there may be obstacles. One concern that a lot of people have is that in the rush to develop telemedicine programs, a lot of facilities may spend a fair amount of money to get these established and not have the adequate base of patients necessary to support the program, and secondly, may not be really considering that this is a kind of a slow developmental process. People aren't just going to flock into telemedicine. It's unlikely that we will go, for example, from fewer than 1,000 patients seen in all of 1993 to the tens or hundreds of thousands that might be necessary to support these programs. So while they have the potential to be very cost-effective in certain circumstances, I think what we're just going to have to do is study the problem as telemedicine develops and find out what sort of systems are cost-effective and what others may not be.
Mm-hmm. But just our number again is 1-800-848-2298 if you want to join our discussion on telemedicine. Just on the question of personnel, you used the code phrase, Janice, more efficient use of personnel. Nurses are going to be laid off. Isn't that the bottom line? Personnel, healthcare personnel are going to be laid off as we need fewer personnel to handle patient needs. Is that true?
Well, I can't say what individual healthcare providers will do with the cost savings and how they will utilize personnel. They may redeploy personnel in another way and get the administrative and the repetitive types of processes that don't involve patient care onto the technological end of things. So I think that's a natural assumption people want to go to layoffs. Technology does drive more efficiencies, and I think we've seen that in other businesses, not just healthcare. Banking being an example where you do have the replacement of individuals by machines. I don't think that replaces the human quality in healthcare. But I think there are ways you can save. For example, UCLA, in their yearly operating expenditures of supporting their radiology department, spends about $2.44 million a year in storage of film and personnel that drives the trucks to do that and a variety of other sources where that type of money could be redeployed into other healthcare in a system where digital images are stored. So I think it frees up, and I'd rather look at it as a redeployment.
The optimistic view. Al from Berkeley joins us now. Hello, Al. You're on the Communications Revolution.
Hello. I have two questions. The first is, the person for Pacific Bell said that there were a lot could be cost efficiencies, savings, and so forth. But I've always heard that the one industry that resists any such efficiencies is the health industry, and that the use of technology in health has actually been one of the reasons for the skyrocketing costs in healthcare, that you get more scanning equipment, MRI kind of equipment in the Bay Area than you've got in all of Canada, that kind of thing. Isn't this one more sort of major addition on a technology boom that that people pay for, but they don't really get the basic services from?
Thank you, Al, for your call. Janice Rylander.
I think what's happening in healthcare right now and the emphasis that's being put both from Washington and just the emphasis on the industry is to look at those spiraling costs, to be able to look at being more efficient in managing their costs. I think technology is one way to do that and has been proven more in the administrative side of healthcare, and I think what we're talking about now is looking at whether that can extend into the clinical. But there is a push right now in healthcare. In fact, I think there was a report that in the last month or so that indicated that for the first time, the growth in healthcare expenses was either flat or reduced. So I think things are changing. I think the industry is starting to discipline themselves and look for ways to cut those redundant expenses, and I think they have been resistant. I think that's changing, and I think technology is one way that they will look to help cut some costs.
So you see technology cutting costs rather than driving them up, as this caller suggests. Jim Grigsby.
Well, Janice may be correct about administration and savings as a result of technology. I don't know a lot about that. I do have some concerns, though, over the fact that nearly every major technological innovation in medicine over the last, well, quite a number of years has led to increased costs. And for example, if you look at some of what was said about CT scans or MRI when they first came out, it was argued that they would contribute to more cost-effective medical care. We were eliminating certain tests that were invasive and possibly unnecessary. And in fact, costs have tended to rise with the introduction of new technologies. That's not necessarily all bad. You know, one of the proposed advantages of telemedicine is that it increases access to care, so that if people who now don't have access are able to receive medical services that they require, then perhaps that's a cost that the society feels it's willing to bear. But I'm somewhat more cautious about whether or not we're really going to achieve great savings. Again, I think research needs to be done on that.
I would just ask that, for example, we have something that's going to be as part of our trust fund that's been set up between a hospital and in one city and a clinic in another to provide 24-hour neurological capability by using telecommunications to link to send CAT scans. And just my common sense approach would say that linking through a communications line would be more cost-effective than having a neurologist on site 24 hours a day to be able to provide that capability. So I do see that there's some sharing of resources, too, very expensive resources.
Yeah, I'd be curious if that's true, if your link online, if you're a major hospital, is costing you $75,000 a month, as U.S. Sprint wants to charge. It's an open point at this point in time. Let's bring Bob into the show. Welcome to the program. Bob?
Hello.
Hi, Bob.
I've been involved in the healthcare industry for quite some time from the technology point of view, and I have some concerns about the cost that hospitals incur. For instance, in a MRI, we did a study once that the average patient that comes into the hospital, the average number of patients, it costs $300 per patient just for the cost of the maintenance program that was required from the manufacturer. And so we had to be in a situation where we had to run the unit 16 hours a day, and you had to push patients through. And so there was this situation developing where were the patients being put through the MRI because they needed to go through it, or are they being pushed into it because we have to justify the cost? And another problem that developed is quality assurance. There, in a MRI, you're very dependent on software to determine the quality of what's being seen within the patient. So you have to depend on the manufacturer to provide that quality assurance, and there's really no one out there. The FDA regulates these devices under what they call a 510K, and so the industry is kind of required to regulate themselves, but there have been some serious problems in the past with regulation by the industry, you know, with the Dow Corning thing, and I'm just wondering, has the FDA been looking at this as a medical device, and are they considering putting a 510K on it?
Excellent points, Bob. I thank you very much for your call. Does anyone know if there's going to be any FDA regulation of the software that drives some of this technology?
I don't know specifically about the software. My understanding at this point, though, is that the FDA is not planning to treat telemedicine or associated technology as a medical device.
I think those are two good warnings that Bob offers from his frontline experience, and certainly trying to justify the technology by using it when it might not be necessary to use it. Let's very quickly try to get one more caller in from Kansas City. Hello, Mel, you're on the air.
Yes, how are you today? I'm curious, how does this plan that we've been talking about fit in with President Clinton's proposal that he has on the table right now?
A simple question. Thanks, Mel, for your call. Do either of you know what the status of telemedicine is in relation to the Health Care Security Act? Jim Grigsby, do you know?
I don't know the details of it. I do know that probably progress on the issue of reimbursing for telemedicine services is tied up with the Health Security Act. My understanding is that the Healthcare Financing Administration has sent some language to Capitol Hill that was included in the original bill. I'm sure it's been marked up quite a bit since that point, but I would guess that it's going to, the fate will be determined in part by what happens with the healthcare reform.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the aspect to watch is an amendment to the Health Security Act added by Representative Mike Sinar, Democrat of Oklahoma. But that does wrap it up for today. We're going to have to leave it on the legislative point. My guests have been Jim Grigsby and Janice Rylander. I thank all of you who called into our program. Please join us again next time. I'm Jude Tillman for the Communications Revolution.
The Communications Revolution is directed by John Rieger. The technical consultant is Tim Pozar. Our on-air engineer is Jim Bennett. Indigo Thumb is the administrative assistant. Music created by Tony Kniff. You can receive a free resource list for today's program by sending a stamped